Tonight's lesson is about prayer. We've been talking about Jesus last few weeks. We've talked about some of the questions the Lord asked. Tonight we want to give attention to this subject, learning from Jesus how to pray. A lot of things related to the Christian life that are not all that difficult. We may not have ever learned the mechanics of music, but we can pick up a book and see, okay, these are the words, and kind of hear the tune, and we can figure out how to find the Bible books and follow along, and things related to giving and other aspects of the Christian life are not all that difficult. But when it comes to prayer, you think that's an area wherein people struggle? With prayer. Is that an area where you think some people struggle when it comes to praying? I do. And if you get close to people who are Christians, you might find that you're surprised as far as just how often they struggle with prayer. I want to just kind of toss that topic around for a couple of minutes and see if we can maybe open that up just a little bit. Maybe we can start out with this question. Why do you think people struggle with prayer? Sherman, we'll start with you. Well, you could take that in either direction, I guess. There may be some distinctions there. There also might be some overlapping.
Well, as far as men go in the public setting, they might be nervous and afraid they might say the wrong thing, or may feel like they're not doing good enough, those kind of things.
Okay. Anytime you're in a public setting, there's going to be more pressure than if you're in a private setting. If you're putting on a demonstration for somebody, that's a whole lot more involved, and you run a greater risk in some areas, whereas if you were the one doing it in your own little shop or in your own private space and you're just practicing. So it's, okay, this is for public consumption now. So sometimes that can cause people to feel pressured, and that may or may not go well. If you need a copy of the material, we still have some books in the back. What else, Ray?
I think we have a lot of doubts that prayer's going to be answered the way we want it to be answered.
Yeah. When you really get down to prayer, if you talk to people on a really personal level and you start thinking about what prayer involves, you know, it's either faith or not. And it can be, as we'll talk about a little later, the double-mindedness where you think, well, I want to believe that God, and I sort of believe you have the power, but, I mean, this is pretty big, and can you really pull that off? A lot of people might not really say that, but that is really what's at the in the back of their minds. It's at the root of prayer. What else? Problems when it comes to prayer. Difficulties, hardships. Stan?
People know how to talk to each other. They know what their thought process is. They know how they go about thinking about a particular thing. But when it comes to speaking or praying to God, there's misconception that it needs to be, because we're speaking to the Almighty God, that it needs to be formal. And therefore, it takes it out of the realm of what they're used to doing. And I think if people would get the idea that God will hear them or listen to what they have to say, if they would just talk to Him the way they talk to each other, it would be a whole lot easier.
For a new Christian, if you talk to somebody who has been baptized recently, and you ask them, I mean, they're coming from a background where they were not religious, and maybe they, you know, lived for 40, 50 years, they've been around for a little while, you'll probably find their prayer is going to be one of the things that they really struggle with. It's sort of, how do I do it? And it's, do I talk to God like a friend? Or we alluded to this a little bit as far as the Sunday class. Do you remember how we talked about God's foreknowledge? You know, God declares the end from the beginning, past, present tense for us, and God knows all things. Everything's sort of is with Him. If you're communicating with a being who already knows what you're going to ask, and you think about that very often, it's kind of like sometimes, well why even pray? Or how many times should I pray about that? I've been praying about that for a week, a month, a year, maybe 10 years, 20 years, all my life. Should I continue to pray? So there are a lot of questions that people pose and ponder when it comes to prayer. And in my mind, even though it may on the one hand seem to be one of the simplest subjects in the Bible, if you really start to develop it and try to explore it, I think there are some aspects to it that you say this is probably one of the more complex subjects in the Bible, at least to do it and do it well.
Well, I've got a question, and it's going to deviate a little bit from what you're talking I'm kind of curious. This lesson is going to start out by the disciples and apostles, or, well, disciples at the time, asking him to teach them to pray. What about the situation at that present time? When you take into account the fact that the Jews, they were steeped in the law, because the Jewish law was their law. It was their civil law as well as their religious law. They had an understanding of that. And there are times when Jesus talks about various people who have prayed. He talked about those who were praying in public. He uses an example, et cetera, et cetera. Why did these men ask him to teach them how to pray?
You don't have a lot of information about a specific answer, but when you look at the life of Jesus, he is going to be someone that was unlike anybody else in that day and time. His teachings were different. His signs were different. His manner of life, I mean, he didn't sin. That would make him distinctive. So he's somebody that you're thinking, okay, he's definitely from God, exactly where he falls in, you know, prophet, teacher, you know, exactly who is he, some kind of special servant. And when you deal with, for example, Mark 1, verse 35, Jesus went out early to pray, and that seems to have been a regular practice. The Garden of Gethsemane, the disciples had been there before. They're seeing some things with him that we do the same thing. For example, if you have somebody that likes to fish and maybe doesn't fish very much or doesn't fish that often, or you have, looking at it maybe from an inside perspective, somebody who makes the best meals, don't you think there would be some people who would have a desire to say, show me how to cook like that? My pizza, my brownies don't turn out like that. I'd like to know how you make your cake. I'd like to know how you catch so many fish. So this is more of a studied opinion rather than pointing to a specific passage. But when they began to see that in the life of Jesus, it's kind of like, okay, you have an understanding of this area that is beyond where we are, what our ability to grasp is. So teach us to pray. That would be my answer to the question. There may be more to it than that, but at least that would be my response. The other aspect of this that I'll mention is when you think about prayer, and this might even be true for husband and wife, or it might be true between parents and children, it's not, as far as I can tell, something that's discussed as often as some other topics. For example, I suspect that there are some husbands and wives, they may be very close in a lot of areas. But when it comes to sharing their prayers, I'm praying about this, I'm praying about that, it's just sort of polar opposites. That information is not shared. It's almost like it's a national government secret when it comes to prayer. So for a lot of people, as I think about prayer, it in my mind is something that maybe they do a little of it, maybe they do a lot of it, but it is a deeply personal matter for them. And they might say to somebody, I'm praying for you, but starting to share some of the details and so forth, that's where people start to a lot of times withdraw and they get very uncomfortable. We can understand, I think, some of the reasons for that. But at the same time, if that's the way it is with a lot of people, then that information that would be helpful to share and that information that might help you pray better is being withheld. And then you have to try to, you know, kind of sort this out on your own. And maybe after 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you've finally gotten to a point where you're pretty good at it. But what about the other people who could have profited from that? So, like I say, from that perspective, in my mind, it's a topic that is not probably dealt with enough. And for a lot of people, it's intensely personal.
I've run across one congregation that did not believe that you could pray for yourself for any reason. The only congregation I've ever run into, even Christ prayed for himself. In other words, I couldn't pray for my health. I couldn't pray to get a better job. I could pray for you, like pray for somebody else, but I couldn't pray for myself.
That's definitely interesting. I guess I'm wondering what happens if you were in a position where you're hungry and there's nobody else around, there's no phone to phone somebody. I guess you just starve. I don't know. That's very curious. Did they justify that somehow, or they just said this is our view?
They just didn't think we had authority to pray for ourselves.
Well, what about the praying for forgiveness of your sins? Would you have to ask somebody else to do it for you?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Huh. Well, it takes all kinds, I guess, to make the world go around, and sometimes you find some unusual views when it comes to prayer. All right, anything else you want to add to us before we start into the material? Okay. This comes from page 36, and then we'll flip over to page 37. He mentions that prayer is a sacred privilege for God's children. The words of an old song remind us that prayer will change the night to day. Prayer is not only a privilege, it is an opportunity to commune with God. That is right. I think it's often undervalued. We all probably know that a lot of people really don't turn to prayer as much as they might when times are good, but when they begin to undergo some stressful times, some difficult times, then it's, let's pray. And you see that illustrated well with 9/11. Terrorist attack, the United States, or you have another situation where there is some emergency and people call on God, sort of like Jonah on the boat, okay? You know, rough seas, everybody's going to call on the God and so forth. But that's not the way that God intended for prayer to work, and that's not the way the Bible pictures prayer working. Righteous people through the ages have turned to God in prayer, both in times of joy and in hours of grief. We have men like Abraham, Moses, David, Elijah, and they found great strength in prayer. Acts 2, as we think about what happened after people became Christians, there in verse 38, the Bible says in verse 42, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship and in breaking of bread and the prayers. Though prayer is sacred to Christians, some, I think I would cross that word out and write most, or many, many people have used it for wrong purposes, as we see from some of the following passages. Let's get three helpers lined up. In just a little bit, we'll take a look at James chapter 4, verse 3. That'll be Sherman. Then we'll slip over to the book of Luke and read about the Pharisee and the publican, Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. That will be Gary. And then from Matthew chapter 23, verse 14, we'll look at some information about the scribes and Pharisees. Matthew 23, verse 14. That'll be Steve, and that's Steve Saylor. All right, Sherman, let's go back to you. James chapter 4, verse 3.
You ask and you do not receive, because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your own pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Let's fill in our blank. James said you ask, but you don't receive. The reason for that is you ask how?
Amiss.
What's he mean by that? You ask amiss.
For the wrong reason.
All right, the motivation is wrong. The reason is wrong. Can you think of some prayers that would be wrong as far as the motivation, the purpose behind the prayer?
Winning the lottery.
All right. You said winning the lottery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some people who would pray. I've actually seen that. I've mentioned that a few times as far as I'm going to go buy a lottery ticket, or I'm going to bet in the ponies, whatever it might be, and they say a prayer before they buy the ticket or before they place the bet in the ponies. So, yes, there are some people who actually do that. What else? Improper motivation when it comes to prayer. Okay. Sometimes you have people who, in that case, I think pride would certainly be part of the problem, but people want something that's going to be better than another person for a reason that's not noble. So it might seem kind of petty to us, but there are people who have that. You know, God, I want my cake to win at the 4-H County Fair. I want the blue ribbon. You think there's some people, maybe more ladies than men, but do you think there's some people who have prayed that prayer? God, I want to win the blue ribbon. Now, if you're an 8-year-old child in 4-H, you think they might pray that prayer? Okay, I can see that coming from a child who's 7 or 8. They haven't learned some things. But if you are 25 or 45 and you're praying that kind of prayer, that's a problem. What else? Improper motivation.
Well, to turn that around, if you might pray that the Lord would strike your neighbor's lawn so that it dries up as a mess so the church looks better.
Okay.
In other words, a negative type.
Yeah, it is. Or thinking about praying for a neighbor, I would really rather have that house down the street. He doesn't want to sell. I'm just going to pray God's going to strike him dead. And then the house is going to go up for the market, you know, and I'm going to be able to sell my house, and I'm going to... So people do pray those selfish kinds of prayers. That was being done by the people in James 4, and James says that's not right. Another thought there before we move on with the second passage. Okay, Luke chapter 18, let's start with verse 9 and go down through verse 14.
And he spake this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. Two men went up into the temple to pray, and one a Pharisee and the other a publican. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank thee that I am not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. I fast twice in the week, I give tithes of all that I possess, and the publican, standing afar off, would not lift up so much as his eyes unto heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone that exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted.
Thank you. Let's fill in the blanks and then talk about it for a minute. How did the Pharisee misuse prayer? What did he do?
Exalted himself.
He bragged. He boasted. He exalted himself. We've mentioned this a few times, but how can prayer be misused? And I'm thinking specifically in a public context in worship. Now in this case, it's somewhat public. He's out there at the temple and he's praying. How can prayer be misused at an assembly?
You could say certain things that are targeted at certain people in the group. So, I mean, like in a negative way.
Okay, you could do that. You could say, well, we sure hope Brother X repents soon. We sure hope Sister S, you know, starts wearing more modest clothes, God. You know, you could do those kinds of things, and I think if you look long enough and hard enough, you'll find some congregations where that's probably been done. What else? Misuse of prayer in a public assembly. Well, do you think somebody might give a resume like this guy did? God, I'm thankful that, and you just kind of go through the list? When you look at prayer, Jesus pictures it as a package deal. Prayer, if you're addressing God, there needs to be a basis for it. Or we might say there needs to be authority. And our authority is Christ. We're in Him, we're in His people, and it's by that authority that we're going to the Father. So it's right to have Jesus in mind, and certainly if we're going to offer that prayer in a public way, to publicly recognize Christ. Who are we praying to? Well, Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount gives us the example of the Father. And that's a good example to follow. And some of the requests are going to be requests. There should be some thanksgiving in there, and it can be a mixture. What about, Stan?
Well, this may not be exactly what you were asking about, but sometimes people, when they pray in public, they become informational. They start telling God what God already knows. I mean, and maybe everybody else already knows it too.
Yeah, you have that. Sometimes a person can offer a rebuke in prayer. You may have a situation, especially now when you think about the presidential election. Do you think that somebody could take a prayer and turn that into a who-to-vote-for speech? That's been done in some congregations. And if you're old enough to remember some of what was taking place back in the 60s with Kennedy, there were some prayers that were said back there that, God, if this guy gets in, you know, we know that our nation is gone. So they may not have been worded exactly like that, but it would have been along those lines. So prevent him from getting in. Save our country. Save the church. Those kinds of things. Well, you can understand, I think, a couple of things. Number one, people probably had some good hearts. They were interested in the church. They were interested in the country. As Sherman mentioned, sometimes with public prayers, you can feel like maybe there's a little more pressure on than at other times. And a prayer, whatever you're saying, may not come out as well as in other cases. But at the same time, be careful. Don't try to turn it into a political rally or a rebuke. So sometimes some lines can get a little murky, and sometimes some lines actually get crossed. But those are things to remember if you are going to lead a public prayer. So worship, that's going to be a male and mixed company, but ladies can also fall into that same category if it's an all-female assembly. Gary?
I'm going back to Bonnie's comment. Amen means so be it, right?
Amen, yes. Well, this is true, yes.
Okay, because I mean, I think if you think about it that way, you go up to the highest authority figure there is and say, so be it. You know, what? You don't have any authority to say that, so that's why it's important to mention Christ and the relationship there.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you have no reason or no, you know, clearance to get to that level.
Okay. Anybody else? All right, let's pick up our next reference on page 37. This is from Matthew chapter 23, verse 14.
Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses and pour a pretext to make long prayers. Therefore, you will receive greater condemnation.
All right, here's a question. Tell what was wrong with the scribes and the Pharisees' prayers. They were prayers of pretense. Sure enough, as I say this, somebody's going to say I'm guilty of it, but... if you were to ever be a preacher, and there probably would be some other professions where this would be true as well, you would likely have a friend or a family member say, well, you use that tone. Mom, oh, let's make it a little more generic, for example. Is there a mom tone with kids? All right, yeah, there you go. I didn't say that, didn't think about that, but good for you. All right, there are certain looks, and sometimes there are certain tones that people use. And preachers sometimes fall into that same category. You might have a spouse say, or you might have a child say, that's your preacher tone, or that's your professor tone, or that is your whatever tone. Do you think that people might have a prayer tone? Now, that in and of itself is probably not going to be bad. Maybe they're going to try to amplify, they're going to try to project their voice so people can hear. Nothing wrong with that. But you do want to be careful as far as sort of switching modes, where it's, this is my ordinary mode, but if I'm going to do this in a public service, then I'm going to put on the super holy garments and I'm going to be super religious. No, no, no. But sometimes, and that's, I think, what you see here with Matthew chapter 23, verse 14, as far as the pretense, and Jesus condemned it. Anything that you want to ask before we pick up our next few verses? Okay? Proverbs 28, verse 9 is next. Who wants to take care of that? You have a minute to get there. Proverbs 28, verse 9. Jeff, and then we'll take a look at Psalm 66, verse 18. Who wants Gary? 66, 18 from Psalms. We'll just get two more. James 1, 5 to 7. Thanks, Carol. And then Lois, if you'd pick up Matthew 6, verse 7 for a fourth one. Let's go back to 4a, Proverbs chapter 28, verse 9. I'm sorry.
First, back to this one. Isn't the pretense make on prayer, doesn't that comment before it, for you devour where there's houses, wasn't that more, not that they were just making long prayers or that they were making a different tone of voice when they prayed, wasn't that more that they were doing the wrong thing and then making prayers that made them sound like they were doing the right thing more than a tone of voice?
Well, the pretense was the show. I think for us, the show is probably going to come out in tone. But yes, for them, they put on a really good show. And Jesus says, let's go back and see what they did. They were devouring the widows' houses. So they were the people who were abusing the widows, possibly the orphans. And then they show up and they offer these prayers which look so religious and so holy. They could do that in different ways. We know about the phylacteries that the people wore. They enlarged those. Today, as I said, with tone of voice, they would have that ability to go ahead and do that. But the long prayers and the pretense were designed to go ahead and help cover up and mask that hypocrisy. But yes, it was. It's just like mascara, covering up all the bad stuff. And Jesus said, it doesn't cover it. Okay, Proverbs 28, verse 9.
He that turneth away his ear from hearing the law, even his prayer shall be.
Okay, here's a passage where as you look at the wording, you have to think, is this literal or is something else being described? What's the sin as it's described? He that doesn't do what? He that doesn't hear the law. Is the problem really with hearing the law or something else? All right, the problem is not hearing it. That's a metonymy. It's standing for something else. You've heard the law, but you don't want to obey it. And God says, if you're not willing to obey the law, then what should you expect when it comes to prayer? You're not going to be in a right relationship with me. You are an abomination, and don't expect your prayer to be heard. Psalm 66, verse 18.
If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear me.
Okay. What do you think it means to hold sin in the heart?
Hold a grudge against someone.
All right. There could be that.
Basically not walking in the line.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the sin that we look at, we can't literally hold it in the heart, can we? If you steal something, you can't put it in the heart.
No, that desire.
Yes, there is that desire. This is something I've done. This is something I like. This is something that I'm going to continue to do. I'm going to refuse to walk in the light. And God says, if you hold on to that, what's going to be the consequence? If I regard sin in my heart,
he won't listen.
All right, the prayers are not going to be effective. So we want to avoid that pretense that we talked about, bad actions. Here again, you see sinful actions, and God says, don't expect me to respond to your prayers. It's just not going to work that way. James 1, 5 through 7. This takes us into a slightly different area.
But if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men generously
Okay, let's play devil's advocate with God for just a second. Do you think you could argue before God? No, obviously it's just you and me here tonight, but before God that we should be entitled to some doubts when it comes to prayer?
Entitled to what?
Some doubts when it comes to prayer.
Entitled?
Yeah.
Sometimes he says no.
All right, we might say, look, sometimes you say no, sometimes you say yes. We're just not sure, so we've got some doubts for that reason. Why else? What else could we offer to God and say, I've got some doubts, so you should just accept them? Have we ever seen God? No. God ever talked to us? All right, so not directly, just through the Word. God given us a signed agreement? No. So when you start looking at prayer, it really becomes a matter of faith, doesn't it? A lot of things that we would expect with somebody else as far as an agreement, we don't have with God. Now, we do have sufficient, more than sufficient, proof and evidence to believe that he's out there, he's going to fulfill his will, prayer works, and those kinds of things. But we do not have some of the items that we typically have in the world. And yet God says, even though you've not seen me, even though you've not heard my voice directly, even though there's no personal written contract with you, you've got my word and so forth. When it comes to prayer, what do you need to have? Faith. You need to believe. And God says, how does that faith need to work when it comes to wavering and doubting? Work on eliminating the doubts. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been in some times and in some circumstances where you can pray about something and doubt is a real temptation. Anybody feel like they've ever been there?
Well, sometimes when I'm praying for something and I'm not really sure which is the best choice to make, but I really like this choice, so I always pray that I get that choice, and then I know that if I do everything I can to make that choice happen, if it doesn't happen, then it was God's will. But if I just sit there and say, boy, I hope that happens, and I don't know, do anything about it, I don't know if that was my will or God's will.
That's helpful. Anything else, Micah, back there?
No, you're talking about more or less doubting if your prayers are heard based on your current spiritual status.
Okay. All right. That would be part of it. Is God really out there? Now, hopefully, if that's where we're struggling, we can resolve that God is really out there. He is all-powerful, all-knowing, and all those kinds of things. But for some people, they're going to be dealing with those matters. But if those matters are resolved, can you think of a scenario? Maybe we can toss out a couple here. Where the circumstances are so challenging that maybe you've been a Christian for several years, but still, as you look at the circumstances, you have to say, you know, God, I'll give you one to kind of get the ball started. Do you remember the illustration I gave about 3 weeks ago that was sitting in the chair? Remember that big gong that we talked about? And that gong was going to be pulled back and it's going to swing at you. It's going to be about 250 pounds. Remember that illustration? And you stay in the chair. You've got this 250 pound weight swinging at you and it's secure and somebody says, you're not going to be hurt. I guarantee that. If we had prayed, God said, this is what I'm going to do. I want you to pray, and I'm going to answer your prayer. And you sit there in the chair, don't strap yourself in, and I'm going to have one of my angels go and pull the gong back. You think the faith might fail for some folks? Faith might begin to waver in doubt, people leaping out of the chair. I suspect that's true. Why? Because faith has now been put to a severe test, and it's failed. Think about Peter. What did he say not long before the Lord? Everybody may leave you. I won't. And Jesus said, I prayed for you. Your faith is going to be tested, and it's going to be tested greatly. So when people come along and say, well, I believe, I have faith, I don't believe that they're lying. But I do believe that we need to be careful, because remember that Old Testament proverb? Pride goes before the fall. And when somebody comes along and says, well, I've got faith in God, you might find that that faith is just really, really tested. Anybody want to toss out a scenario or two as far as how and when faith might be really tested?
You pray for something for many years and you see nothing ever changes with the situation you're praying about.
Okay, time And that could involve a lot of different things. But if you've been praying about something for a long period of time, and remember, Abraham had to die in faith. God's promise came true, but Abraham did not live long enough to see it. So that's a good illustration. What else?
Serious medical problems for a loved one.
Okay. What will we say as far as on the list of incurable diseases? AIDS is still incurable, isn't it?
It can be managed.
Okay, but it can't be cured. Okay. If somebody that was a loved one picked up AIDS and they said, I want you to pray that a cure for AIDS will be found in my lifetime before I'm ready for the grave, would you have enough faith to pray for that? Or would you say, well, science has said there is no cure. We can manage it, but there is no cure. And somebody says, do you have the faith in God to pray for a cure? Now, you'd have to kind of go back with Carol and make sure that you're in correlation with God's will on that particular point. But I'm just trying to point out that there are times where faith is really, really tested, and that begins to separate the men from the boys. And if you can get to a level where that faith says, God, I believe. Wasn't it the centurion? The sick servant? Maybe at Matthew chapter 8, I'd have to go back and look right now. But Jesus said, he was a fellow, he said, I'm also under authority. I tell this one to go and, you know, come, and he does what I say. And Jesus said, I've not found so great a faith where? In Israel. And here this faith is among you. And God seems pleased by that. Hebrews 11, you have there the great hall of faith. But people, you know, by faith, Jericho, the walls were brought down and so forth. And each time it's by faith. Noah built an ark by faith. Abraham went out by faith, by faith, by faith. And to me, the more I study, think, and pray, the key to effective prayer is faith. Even, and it may be in a miraculous context, remember what Jesus talked about when he said, move this mountain? What was involved? You've got to believe. There has to be faith. So this is, in my mind, if not the most difficult aspect and element of prayer, it is right up there with that, with whatever else you might want to list. But it does get very, very difficult to say, God, I believe, and whatever indications of unbelief come my way, unless this is contrary to your will, I'm going to keep the faith. And that's the level of prayer that we should strive for and seek to keep throughout life. That's right. That's a question. That would be, as I said, you'd have to go back to the thought that you advanced earlier about praying in accordance with God's will. We might really want that to happen because that's a very precious loved one to us. Could be spouse, child, whoever that might be. But still, you have to, at the end of the day, recognize that God's will may not be yes in that set of circumstances for some other reasons. But still, to have the faith there that God, if this is your will, this will happen. This is something that you can do. That's really where things begin to get interesting.
So how do you know that prayer is not being effective if it's not God's will? I mean, you're praying for one thing, but it's not God's will. I mean, how do you come to that conclusion that God's will is not what you really are praying without?
You remember earlier I said this is a complicated topic? Well, there's a good example of that. Remember, let's take Paul, for example. He had what problem? Thorn in the flesh. We don't know what that was. There's been a lot of speculation about that. How many times did he ask God to take it away? Three. What did God say? No. So there were some times, and Moses was in the same boat. You go back and look at the Old Testament, God said, I've heard about this enough, don't pray about it anymore. Now, we're not in the same boat from the standpoint that God is not giving us a direct message. So there's no way for us to know that I prayed about this maybe 25 times or I prayed about this for 5 years. God has said no. Therefore, I'm going to give up on the prayer. You do have, though, remember Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. Or let's see. Yeah, I think it's 9 through 14. No, it's Luke 18, 1 through 8. That would be about the lady, the widow and the judge. She was so persistent, and Jesus talked about the fact that she was persistent, and that kind of persistence needs to be used in prayer. So if you want to throw out a specific situation, let's say that we are thinking in terms of evangelism, and we're praying for a congregation to be established at Point X. There's never been a church there in that county or in that part of a foreign country. Okay, in that case, could we determine that it would be consistent with God's will to have Christians in that area? I think we can say yes to that, because God's will is for the gospel to go everywhere. Okay, let's say that we try to do that, and that prayer is not answered as far as a yes for 10 or 20 years. Would we say the prayer is a failure? I don't think we'd want to say that. But I think we want to say that it is a prayer which may not be answered in our lifetime, but that's consistent with God's will, so we're going to continue to pray for that. And in that case, I think I might pray that, God, if that can't be done in my lifetime, for whatever reason, after I leave this earth, may it be done. So when you have a prayer that you can say, this lines up with other passages, it's consistent with God's will, I'm just going to go on record and say, if that's something that really matters to it, to us, then until my dying breath, I would persist in that prayer. And even, like I say, with some of those prayers, say to God that if, you know, this can't be fulfilled in my lifetime, I've got faith that you can do it after I die. And I don't need to see the fulfillment of that prayer. I believe that you heard me, and I believe that what's right is going to be done.
Sometimes when I offer a prayer, regardless of what it's for, whether it's for somebody else's help, I catch myself saying, not my will, but your will be done. And then afterwards I think, well, maybe my faith is not strong enough. I've already given God a way out. And that strikes me at times that maybe at that particular time my faith was not strong enough.
That's possible. But there again, you know,
God's way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that can be used as well. But these are things that as you begin to think about prayer more and more, you begin to sort of plug these in. And let me toss this in so it doesn't get left out. Remember what Paul talked about in Romans chapter 8? He talked about the Spirit making intercession for us with groanings which can't be uttered. The short version of that to me is, there are going to be times where we foul up prayers for various reasons. We may not know what to pray for. We may pray for this because we think it's good, and that would have been an absolute disaster. We may not have prayed hard enough for this. Maybe we prayed too hard for that. And we sort of get things mixed up a lot. As I understand Romans 8, the Holy Spirit is sort of a helper when it comes to prayer. He's there trying to fix things and adjust things and make intercession. So we don't have to get it perfect. You know, God knows the heart. He searches the heart. You also have that in Romans chapter 8. That statement is made about the Spirit. So if you have someone who is trying to abide by the general conditions, regulations, rules associated with prayer, and doing that persistently, then you have that divine aid in Romans chapter 8, which should be of great consolation to us. And some of that could go back into what Ray and Betty were talking about. Anything else you want to add or ask on that point before we maybe toss something else into the mix? Okay, then let me toss this in. If you're under the age of probably 45, then you maybe can't identify with this as well as some people who've hit the age of 45 or 50. But when you look at the subject of providence, anybody remember what providence is? What's providence mean? All right, God's working through natural law to care for us, help us, answer prayer, and those kinds of things. You know, I've lived long enough now to look back on 30-plus years of living as a Christian. And people can, even if they are not a religious person, people can say, earlier life experiences helped me with this. I learned this when I was in the military. I learned this when I was in high school. I learned this when I was in 4-H. And those items that I learned have helped me later in life. So that is a natural part of life. But with a Christian, the Bible teaches that God is also involved in life. There are his providential workings, so to speak. And as people pray, the longer you live, and this may not be stating it too well, but let me suggest that the longer you live, God has in some respects more to work from. There were some things that may have happened in the past, things that you may have done, people that you may have met, experiences that you may have had, And God is able to use those things in a lot of different ways, sometimes to answer prayer later in life. For example, let's suppose that you are struggling with a child. You've got a two-year-old or maybe a five-year-old you're having some difficulties with, and you are just absolutely frustrated thinking, how am I going to raise the child? But you know, then you remember, hey, we used to have some neighbors, or I was a babysitter way back when. And I remember that there was a child that I babysat for, or there were some parents that I watched, and this was a technique that they used. It was very helpful. And I've been praying to God for some wisdom on how to deal with my five-year-old, and then all of a sudden, one day, that memory pops into the head. And you get that idea. And that helps you deal with your five-year-old. Would you say that God could have answered your prayer in that way? Absolutely. I mean, you're praying for help. There is no miraculous activity taking place there. Going back to what we said in Sunday's class, time with us, past, present, future. And we get so locked into that that we talk about God's foreknowledge when, from one perspective, it's not foreknowledge at all. Remember what we said if you're in that class at the end of class. With God, past, present, future are all wrapped up right there. So as we're thinking about events which have happened in our past, it's not really the past with God. Everything is right there. And it's sort of like shifting around bowls on a kitchen counter or shifting around chess pieces. God says, okay, I can work here and here. The circumstances, the items have taken place in your life. This is something that you need right now. This is something that you're praying. And we can pull over here or pull from here or there to help that need. Now, how all that works, I don't know. That is just way beyond us as far as human beings. But as we pray, we have to keep in mind providence and keeping in mind the fact that with God, the future is just as apparent before Him as the past and the present, and He's able to work all that to our benefit when it comes to prayer. And if you can sort of get your head around that, I think the next time that you face a very great difficulty in life, that will help you. That the God that I'm appealing to, He knew that this was going to come. That's before Him right now, and it's been before Him all the time. Additional thoughts that you have on that point? Okay. Well, let's pick up with where we left off next time then, Lord willing. And if you have some additional questions over what we talked about tonight, we'll pick it up then. Thank you.